You think I have not hurt you? You honor me with your lips, but your heart is far from me. With your mouth, you worship me, but in your deeds, in your lifestyle, in your actions, in the way you live, you dishonor me. You dishonor me.
Hello again.
Hello, Dave.
So, I'm sorry for shutting down your witch idea, Dave.
No. It's just because I watched it last night and properly. And I'd only seen bits of it, but fucking hell, what film? Jesus.
I saw it probably, was it about 5 years ago it came out?
Yeah, about 5 years. But I didn't realise just how disturbing it is. I mean, like the opening bit with the witch and the baby is just horrible. And
I'm not even sure I remember that bit.
Well, it sort of like implicates that she bloody grinds it into like mush, you know. And then the acting's amazing in it. The little lad is amazing in it, I thought. And old Finchie.
Finchie's good, isn't he? Yeah.
Finchie's fantastic in it.
Yeah.
He's so bleak. He's so bleak and harrowing.
He is a very versatile actor, him.
Oh, he's great actor. He was good in Chernobyl.
Yeah,
it's good. And then, I didn't see that coming with the goat.
Well, the thing is, I'd heard that the goat actually spoke.
Yes.
And I was really looking forward to that bit. And I was really disappointed when it actually happened because I was hoping that it would be some really bizarre, you know, the goat, well, you'd actually see the goat speak, which would have been really creepy, I thought.
It could be, or it could go. The problem with that is, I suppose, the danger with that is it could go down the route of like the goodies when they're singing, the animals singing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in that.
Well, I was thinking of Johnny Morris.
The Goonies and the Beanstalk episode, yeah, or Johnny Morris. Who wants to be a millionaire? I do.
Yeah. But the thing is, sausage's dog.
Yeah, exactly. But I know what you mean. It would, if they could have done that kind of well, like really close up on its face, sort of talking, or even just showing its eyes or something, and it was talking back. But instead, they chose sort of like some dodgy geezer to come around the back of the girl, which I thought was getting really in the realms of like nonstum or paedophilia, really. How old's she supposed to be? How old is she?
I've not seen it for so long, I can't remember a lot of detail.
A bit, doesn't it? You know, interesting film though. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think what's impressive about it is the language, isn't it? Because the guy
amazing.
Who wrote it spent an age, you know, Eggers. Getting the language right, this ancient language. He wanted to make it as authentic as he could.
Yeah.
I think that really does add to it. It is a great little story.
It is. Brilliant. Yeah. It's one of the most effective little horror films I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
And I say little because I thought Midsommar was very good.
No, I've not seen that.
But that's, you wouldn't call that a little horror film. That's quite a big production, really. And it's quite Wicker Man-esque, really. Midsommar. It's definitely Wicker Man-esque, but I think you'll really like Midsommar.
I've heard mixed things about it.
It's very long. It's a long film. It's longer than it needs be, but it's very atmospheric, really well done, really creepy. Builds up fabulously towards the climax, you know. Yeah, which is very dark. There's some very dark shit in it again, you know.
Yeah, I will watch it on your recommendation then, if you're saying it's good.
I really liked it. And I quite liked Hereditary too. It's done by the
same. Oh, yeah. Hereditary's really good, I thought.
Yeah, I thought so, you know.
I watched that with my daughter, who's 14 now. Well,
Jesus!
Well, she started to get into horrors, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I think she won't watch some of the ones I'm telling her about, like The Exorcist and The Omen, because I think she realises they might be too scary.
Yeah.
So she watched things like Scream and Chucky and those sort of ones. And she'd heard about Hereditary. So I just watched it with her, which may or may not have been the right thing to do, but I thought she could handle it. But when the girl's head gets knocked off in the car, oh, God. I mean, it is such a great moment that it comes completely out of the blue.
Someone joked that actually the meaning of Hereditary is actually her head hit a tree.
Oh, mate. But I always thought that the bit towards the end where Toni Collette got possessed ruined it a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I love the idea of the mother who was a bit, she wasn't well liked, she was a bit distant, a bit strange.
Yeah.
She didn't get on with Toni Collette. I love the idea that she was planning this thing to bring this demon back through her grandkids.
Yeah, I agree. I love the idea of it, and I loved where it went in many ways after the loss of the daughter. Let's put it that way, not to give too many spoilers away for anyone who hasn't seen it. But we've kind of given it away now, anyway, haven't we? in a big way. But the whole thing's kind of unusual. Again, the same way, in a very different way, actually, than how brilliant the acting is in The Witch. The acting in that, in The Hereditary, is brilliant, I think.
It is.
And in Midsommar, you have to say the acting in Midsommar is fantastic. But in Hereditary, I think the son, the way the son reacts to the
loss. I was just thinking of him. You've mentioned him before. He is brilliant in that.
He is brilliant. And I felt that. I thought that was really touching because he goes into obviously, they all go into a real dark depression. And it brings home that thought of loss. And, oh, it's horrible. I mean, it's really... I found that the hardest thing to watch in the whole film. You know, it's very hard to watch that because that's kind of honestly, one of your biggest nightmares, obviously, as a parent. So seeing how the parents reacted and then, but the sibling, you know, how he reacted. So he felt incredibly guilty and he just went in on himself and totally introvert. And you kind of think, where's this film going? Because I didn't know much about it. I did actually know about the first half of the film. I didn't know quite a bit about that, but I didn't know where it was going after that. Had no idea in which direction it went. So when it kind of escalated back into this kind of this occultist sort of supernatural element, that was a big kind of surprise because I didn't see it going into that direction. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right.
I just thought, oh my God, this is going to be like really hard to watch from now on because it's so sad and so depressing and ultimately brilliantly acted, but so sad. Kind of like Ingmar Bergman, you know what I mean? It's like really very sad and hurtful and depressing, you know, in many ways that I kind of waited. I watched it in two halves. And the second time, when I came back to it the second time, it was weeks later because I just thought, oh, I don't know if I can watch this. And I just thought, no, I'll see the end of it. I'll see it through. And it really surprised me the way it went. Like you say, it was a little seriously kind of over the top at the end, but it really surprised me. So I thought, wow, didn't expect that. So I thought it was really good.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the guy who did Hereditary did Midsommar, didn't he?
Correct,
Ari Aster, yeah.
I think it's Ari Aster, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very good. And it's Robert Eggers, isn't it, who does The Witch. Very similar kind of filmmakers in a way because they're making horror in a kind of slightly different light, aren't they? They're doing something a bit like Ben Wheatley as well. Ben Wheatley, he's the same. He's kind of cool with what he does. He does sort of interesting quirky horrors. You know, you've got to say Sightseers is a horror, really, because it's kind of like Nuts in May meets... what's that bloody Badlands or Natural Born Killers? It's like Sightseers. I thought was an amazing film.
Yeah,
I really did.
Well,
you know?
I suppose it would come under this folk horror, wouldn't it? That
most
of those films would have an element of folk horror.
Well, that's interesting about folk horror is very interesting. Is that everyone now?
Not Sightseers, but another film he's done like...
No, I mean...
Kill List and A Field of England.
Kill List and A Field of... You're absolutely right. But actually, Sightseers as well, because I was listening to an interview about it with him the other day, and he says that people always say Sightseers as well because it is basically based in the English countryside, going around these different kind of areas that are traditional, if you like. I know what you mean, though, that you kind of tend to think of folk horror basically as... things that are related around fables and folk tales and
corn,
yeah, and old traditions, you know. But there is definitely an element of that in Sightseers. Kill List, I have yet to see. I can't comment on that.
But oh, Dave, you've got to see it. I think that was his first film, that.
I've heard it. Yeah, I mean, I can't believe I haven't seen it. I've heard it's really good. I've started watching In the Earth, which is his film that he made last year, which looks great. The premise of it is great. These scientists go into this ancient woodland and all sorts of things take place. And I believe it goes completely fucking bonkers at the end.
Oh, is that you're watching that on your dodgy box? You've not.
Don't tell the world.
It's not on Netflix or anything.
It's on there. It's not on Netflix now. So, top secret.
We talked about it at length in one of the last podcasts.
Damn, it's already
the
out.
One before.
It's already out to the public. Shit.
Well, no one knows where you live, Dave. It's all right.
That's a good point, Link. Very good point. Yeah, I'm watching it on my dodgy box. The great thing is I'm compiling a fantastic amount of films. I can organise a history, you see, through my dodgy box. I've just put on it today, In the Mouth of Madness by John Carpenter.
Yeah, I remember that.
One of John Carpenter's last great films. They say it is his last great film because he's done shit after that. And I haven't seen it, so I want to see that. And I put on quite a lot of kind of obscure. I put Mandy on again there, of course.
Mm.
And the Colour Out of Space, or Colour Out of Space, another Nick Cage crazy horror film, which is based on a H.P. Lovecraft. And In the Mouth of Madness is kind of a H.P. Lovecraft homage and Nigel Neal homage, really, because John Carpenter was a massive fan of Nigel Neal, huge fan of Nigel. Yeah. And I think I'm right in saying that when he made Prince of Darkness, which has a lot of Nigel Neal reference to it and has quite a lot of elements of the Stone Tape ideas, and In the Mouth of Madness uses the place Knob's End or Hobbs End, which is used in Quatermass and the Pit, same thing. He actually invents a character in it in the credits called something like Nigel Quatermass, right? Which is basically giving a nod to Nigel Neal. I
think he's
a co-writer or something.
Great name Quatermass was. I always loved that name. But he said he found it in the phone book, didn't he, Nigel Neal?
Yeah.
He was just looking for an interesting name, and he came across that. I think if I was going to change my name, I would change it to Quatermass.
Amazing. I would too, yeah. Yeah, we could be like the Quatermass brothers. Maybe that's what we should call ourselves. We should call ourselves the Quatermass Brothers Podcast.
I did watch a Quatermass when I had a free trial of BritBox. I think it was just called Quatermass, and it was pretty ropey, to be honest.
I didn't
finish it, and it was only like four parts. But
not the one with John Mills, is it? That's not the John.
Yeah, John Mills.
Yeah. Is that the one where
early 80s or 1980?
Yeah, the world's sort of going into some like desperate apocalyptic stage, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the Quatermass is trying to save problems. And it's to do with standing stones, isn't it? There's something to do with standing stones.
Yes, I think so.
Stones.
And there is this like cult in it.
Cult, yeah, that worship the standing stones of like Wiltshire or something like that. Yeah, yeah. So it's got a kind of Children of the Stones kind of element to it, which is kind of cool as well. I went to visit all them earlier in the year, and it's an amazing place there, where they filmed Children of the Stones in Wiltshire, in a place called Avebury.
I thought if we had a bit of a road trip, Dave, we could go around all these great historic places. And
you'd fucking love Avebury. I'd love to take you there, honestly. It's great. It's a great pub in the middle of it too. There's a pub right in the centre of the Standing Stones. It's much more interesting than Stonehenge, really, because you can't get into Stonehenge. Whereas Avebury, you can touch the stones, you can walk around them, and it's a big area, of all these remarkable standing stones. It's so mystical and unusual. And it's fabulous that this cult TV show was made there, Children of the Stones, which is... It's not even like symbolic to the story. They are absolutely crucial and essential to the story. If anyone has not seen Children of the Stone, you can actually get it on YouTube, the whole series, and it's really worth a watch. If you like folk horror, Children of the Stone has been so influential to so many people, including the likes of Ben Wheatley and Robert Eggers. They all cite it, the League of Gentlemen, they all cite it because it fucked them up as kids. They couldn't believe this horrifying children's TV show was on at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on ITV. Brilliant. Yeah,
well, I was going to bring in the, well, a couple of the league, because when we're talking about Hereditary, it reminded me, I mean, I was catching up on the Inside Number Nines on Friday.
Oh, fantastic.
And the is it called The King or Mr. King?
Mr. King, brilliant.
Which I thought was great. I mean, you probably enjoyed it more because it's set in Wales.
Well, and my son went to a school like that.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you always tell me about his school, that it was like, there was only like 30 kids in it.
That is exactly how the class would be for George. You know, George loved it. He didn't quite, he went like this at the end. Oh, it's a bit. I said, no, this is brilliant. Because he'd just watched The Wicker Man recently and he loved it. Yeah, he loved it. And so did his mate Lenny and Lenny's younger brother Earl. We all sat and watched it. And it was over Christmas, actually. And they loved it. And they got it. They totally got it, too. Mm-hmm. They thought it was brilliant. And he kind of thought, oh, you know, it's so Wicker Man and the twist is so. I said, yeah, but it is. But it's them paying homage because Wicker Man means so much to them. This is why it's beautiful. And I didn't see the Wicker Man element coming at all.
No.
Until that very last. And I got it. It was just a bit when the kids started talking to him, doing like the Harvest Festival show, that really I went, ah, I get it now. But up until then, using that kind of paedophilic thing about the teachers being a
I didn't really get that bit about the dicks. Why were there loads of pictures of teachers' dicks?
Because one of the things to be the John Barleycorn was that he had to be uncut.
Right. Yeah. So how did they know they were going to get an uncut teacher when?
Well, they didn't. So the idea was, and they talk about this in their podcast, the idea was that there's been a few like temporary teachers who they've let go because.
Seems very elaborate, doesn't it?
So elaborate. But they were using that. Obviously, they were using that as a ruse to keep us off the scent, to not let us go in that direction. All it was going to be about was that there was this dodgy headmaster who was a bit supercilious and super officious and was pestering the new teacher. This idea that Mr. King was brilliant and Mr. King was a ruse because Mr. King was any number of like teachers that have gone before, you know.
Do you think it was had anything to do with the Yellow King, which is, I'm not massively familiar with that, but you know, the Yellow King story.
Yeah, it could well be.
Which was a part of True Detective, wasn't it?
Yes. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
That you could say that was kind of like American folk horror, couldn't you?
Yeah, yeah. And I did think of Hereditary as well, because channeling a person to become this demon. Well, he wasn't really a demon, I suppose, was he? He was ultimately sacrificed. But, you know, the headgear and all this, reminded me of the demon in Hereditary. Was it Paimon or?
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's kind of, you could tag that into a folk horror idea, couldn't you? What's interesting about the whole folk horror, talking about the League of Gentlemen, talking about Inside Number Nine, is that most people credit that term to Mark Gatiss. They say that Mark Gatiss is the one that came up with the term folk horror. And listening to Ree Shearsmith, he was accrediting it to his friend Mark Gatiss, who has, for the first time, appeared in an Inside Number Nine.
Yeah. Was that the first time he's been in it?
Yeah, and he was in there, I think it was called Merrily Merrily, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When they were on the pedal. I thought that was beautiful, really. Because George was like, at the end of it, he said, I'm really surprised that they've gone down this kind of religious route with the end. I says, no, I think it, again, if you think about it, a religion is still part of folklore, if you like. Religion is still a kind of mythology, you know? And paying the ferryman is a mythology about going to heaven.
That was really good. Yeah.
I thought that was brilliant. It was because you weren't expecting that. You're kind of thinking, who's this mysterious guy on the other side of the river? Is he going to be like a serial killer? Is he going to be this? Mm. And they went in a completely different way. So they were always trying to fool the audience, which I think is fab.
I do marvel at the way they keep coming up with these ideas. I mean, I don't know how many series they've done of that. Is it about 6 or 7 or... You know, they keep coming up with these really interesting, different tales.
Yes.
And it's really good. I mean, we've spoke about them a lot before, how we just love them because they're very like us in a way with the influences they have. They like the same films we like.
Without doubt.
I listened to that podcast you recommended to me.
Oh, the Evolution of Horror podcast.
Yeah, and it was
very good.
Really good, because the guy asked them what the favourite film was, and Steve Pemberton said he's got three, like Don't Look Now, The Wicker Man, and I think it was it Theatre of Blood?
Yes.
And Reese Shearsmith said The Exorcist and The Exorcist 3, and God, I can't tell you how chuffed I was when he said and The Exorcist 3.
I knew you'd love that.
I mean, I know he loves it. I know he's championed it a bit in the past. But to hear him say that, because they are my two favourite films, I'd say. Yeah. And I really do find it difficult to separate them. There's times when I think The Exorcist 3 is my favourite. And then I just think about how powerful and troubling The Exorcist is, and it's a groundbreaking film. It's almost a perfect film.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's hard to believe in many ways that they made that film in 1973, but
incredible.
So it was great to hear that. You know, there's the M.R. James stuff and
It's amazing, really, because a lot of the stuff, I just backtrack very quickly about the Evolution of Horror podcast. There's a lot of love for Exorcist 3 on that podcast.
Yeah, I did listen to a standalone episode about it, and Angel Heart as well.
Correct.
And I thought the woman who really liked The Exorcist 3, she got loads of it wrong, though.
Yeah, she did.
She got loads, but she didn't even know it was the same copper, did she? She didn't even know it was Kinderman.
It's the host, really, who was very good at describing it and putting it in its right context. I think he's a very good host, and he really knows his stuff. And it's mentioned again in other parlance and on other episodes. It's grown hugely in influence. Hugely. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. It's a brilliant film.
Yeah.
And everyone talks about it still, of course, having probably one of the best jump scares ever in any film.
Well,
probably,
it's like you said, it's the best. It's very annoying that it has somehow become about the jump scare, because it is so much more than the jump
scare. Yeah, so much more. It is.
You know, the jump scare is certainly not the thing I particularly look forward to when I'm watching it. To me, there's no crap bits in it, and I don't even, you know, and I'm including the ending, The Exorcist.
Well, what was nice about that conversation they were having about it on that particular podcast is that they brought up how good the dialogue was in it. The dialogue is great. It's witty and pithy, and it goes in all sorts of different directions, and it builds this great relationship with the priest and Kinderman. Brilliant, you know. Can I just go in a slight tangent here? Because something's popped into my head that's quite interesting, I think. I was watching Cruising the other night, right? Which I was actually watching it with my wife, because I said, you've got to watch this, Jack. It's brilliant in places and hysterical in other places. And you'll never see like S&M clubs, gay clubs like this in any other film. It's unbelievable. And Jack just was like, thought it was amazing. Like, we're watching it and like laughing at when Al Pacino starts dancing, you know. Al Pacino's dancing is brilliant. But what I thought was amazing about it, that I don't think I twigged when I watched it, because I watched it twice recently. I watched it on my own through the system and then with my wife. And then what I realized was that the first killing is done by somebody else, completely different.
They all are, Dave.
They are. There's different people, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I certainly thought the first one, I kind of thought the second and third killing were by the guy that Pacino actually arrests in the end. But the first one is a guy that then reappears in the club. So I thought that was brilliantly ambiguous.
Yeah.
And I know I felt a bit of a dick, because I didn't really twig that until watching it the second time. So I think, again, with Friedkin, he's very clever as a filmmaker to put things like this in his films to make you want to watch again, you know?
Yeah, I did hear like a fairly coherent explanation about why he did that. There's a theory behind it. I think Friedkin himself just thought it was a clever idea.
It is, I think. Because,
you know, and he likes to do that. He likes to challenge the audience, doesn't he? And it was clever, but I did find the ending quite flat, I have to say.
Oh, it is quite a flat ending.
Yeah.
And it runs, the actual arrest of the suspect in the end, it all happens very quick.
Yeah, it's almost like anticlimactic, but
it's almost like they ran out of steam a little bit on the whole project. But it's got some brilliant standout scenes, I think. It's a
Yeah.
It's a very, very interesting film of its time. Really watchable as well, especially the first hour and sort of 20 minutes of it. You know, really good.
Talking about Friedkin, one thing I discovered fairly recently was that Friedkin did a TV film of 12 Angry Men.
Did he?
In 1997, I think.
Really?
I didn't know. Which I've got. The cast is amazing, Dave, right? You've got George C. Scott. He wow. plays the, he plays the, you know, the Lee J. Cobb character.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting because Judge yeah. Scott plays the Lee J. Cobb character. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. So the guy playing the Ed Begley character, who's the racist bigot,
yeah.
he's portrayed by this guy who's a bit like a Black Panther who is down on, oh no, not Black Panther, a Nation of Islam member. So he's really down on Latinos. But you've also got Jack Lemmon playing Henry Fonda's character.
Right. Oh, that's yeah. interesting.
Which Jack I don't think was good casting, because Jack Lemmon is always like, he always looks a bit soft, doesn't he? He never yeah. plays someone who's tough. And I think Henry Fonda has a toughness to him.
Well, what he did have, I think, is I wouldn't say he didn't have a toughness, but what he always had, Jack Lemmon, was a kind of nervous energy, kind of jumpy. Mm. He's always kind of jumpy, isn't he? Like,
yeah.
And whereas Fonda is a very kind of cool and still kind of character. He was very much like the kind of actor who, of reason, I'm not saying that Lemmon couldn't do that, probably played it in a different way. Both great actors, don't get me yeah. wrong. I love Jack Lemmon.
But his character is, I mean, obviously it's a new version, but his character is different too. He's a bit more, I don't know, he just comes across as a bit weaker and a bit less confident than Fonda was.
Right, that's interesting.
But on the, you've got the Edward James Olmos, you know, who used to be in oh, Miami yeah. Vice. Yeah, he great. Plays the sort of E.G. Marshall right. character, if you remember him. The sort of quite intelligent, well-spoken, considered guy.
You see, I would have swapped that. I would have had Jack Lemmon play the E.G. Marshall role and Edward James Olmos playing the Henry Fonda role. Because he was always good at being this kind of stern, thoughtful kind of person.
Yeah.
Using his sort of being a kind of really upright kind of guy, changing the opinion of the jury.
Yeah. You've also got playing the Edward Binns character, you might not remember. What's his face? Tony Soprano. James Gandolfini.
Really?
Yeah.
Gandolfini.
And you've got Armand...
Was he playing the, what's he called? What's right. the actor called? The bloody brilliant character actor that's... I hate that. When it fucked my
what, in the original?
Yeah. What's his name? Crazy Like a Fox, Shampoo.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Jack Warden.
Jack
yeah.
Warden.
Yeah, Dave, Jack I can't tell. I can't wait to tell you who plays the Jack Warden character.
I fucking love Jack Warden.
Dave. So Jack Warden, for anybody who can't remember the film that well... He yeah. plays the guy who's got the baseball tickets that are burning a hole in his pocket, and he just wants to get the case over and go to his game. But the guy who plays him in the remake is Tony Danza.
No, it's... Oh, Jesus!
Who's the boss?
Oh, my God.
I couldn't believe it. I thought Gandolfini would have played that.
Absolutely.
Him.
He would have been brilliant. Gandolfini yeah. would have been brilliant. But Tony Danza.
I know, where's Tony Danza come from?
Come on.
Ozzie Davis was in it. I might be wrong about the Edward James Olmos one. I think actually he played the George Voskovok
oh, character, yeah.
the Watchmaker.
The Watchmaker.
I think the guy who played the E.G. Marshall one is that Armin Mueller-Stahl.
I know you know, mean.
Who
yeah.
always plays like a Nazi or a...
Yeah, no, good actor.
Prison of War survivor.
Yeah, it was in that film, The Music Box.
Yes, that's it. So it's a great cast. I couldn't believe the cast when I saw it, especially great for the TV movie.
Maybe Danza's a little bit, but yeah.
Yeah.
A great cast. I'm being a bit unfair on Tony Danza.
You should watch it. It's good.
Will. And yeah. talking
you can of... find it on your box.
Well, do you know what? It may well be there, sir. It may well be there. But what interests me, you know... I couldn't get it out of my head when you started talking about Bill Friedkin films and stuff. Mm. What it's always surprised me is that one of his first films, it might have even been his very first cinematic release, was a British film called The Birthday Party that was based on a Harold Pinter play. You know, Harold Pinter's play is always very odd with its dialogue, very unusual, and starring Robert Shaw.
Yeah.
So
I have seen that. Well, not seen it, I don't think, but
I've seen some of it. It's very bleak and dark, like you would expect with a Harold Pinter job.
Yeah.
But it seems such an unusual sort of beginning for...
Didn't he mentor Danny Dyer, Harold Pinter?
Oh, he may well have done, yeah.
You know, which is weird, but I started reading the Danny Dyer book, you know.
Did you?
I did, which is quite, it was quite funny because he was really having a go at One Direction,
right,
which I liked. But yeah, he was a student of Harold Pinter.
Wow.
Well, that brings us on to another thing I was thinking about tonight, Dave. I was thinking about the abandoned podcasts or the abandoned podcast ideas that we've had and we've never quite done. And we were talking about doing this one on Cockney cunts, weren't we?
Yeah, I'm just looking at, you're absolutely right about Danny Dyer. That's amazing. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't associate, but he, a Cockney cunt that Danny Dyer can also be a very good actor in certain things. So
he's funny. I do like him.
Yeah, me too.
He is just quite funny.
He is. He's a scream.
And he seems a decent bloke, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But the Cockney cunt idea, the plan was that we would talk about these shit Cockney films, because I noticed that there's tons of them on Amazon Prime. They'll let you have them. But, oh, my God, there was so many. And I thought, all right, I'm going to watch one a night and then I'm going to do a podcast. We're going to take the piss out of these films. But honestly, Dave, it broke me. I did about four and I just couldn't face it anymore. I think I had Craig Fairbrass's face etched into my retina. Because it's the same actors turning up all the time. I mean, amazingly, Vinnie Jones wasn't actually in any of them. thank God.
Thank God.
Oh, my God, they are just awful. I mean, you know, they're not all awful, to be fair. You know, some are decent. But when you get, like, a successful film, you just get all these low rent copies, don't you?
Yeah.
Or sequels that just get worse and worse. I mean, I think the first one I started watching was Rise of the Foot Soldier, which was about this Cockney gangster called, was it Carlton Leach, who was a football hooligan turned gangster. And yeah, I mean, that was all right. It wasn't too bad. But then I started watching Rise of the Foot Soldier 2. And that was just a pile of shit. I couldn't finish that one.
I've seen them. I've seen them advertised. Yeah. And I just think, oh, I don't think I can go there.
I can't even remember what it was called. I think it might have been Rise of the Foot Soldier 3, where it was just Craig Fairbass running around Spain, calling people cants and slags.
Getting his shooter. I think the thing is, though, once you've seen, like, the ultimate, like, Cockney wanker film, which I would probably say is, like, Sexy Beast, which is a brilliant film, you know, it's a totally brilliant film. It's such a good film that you know that anything else is going to sort of pale. I know there's one or two others, you know, and you could say even things that aren't gangster films like Nil by Mouth and all that, depicting Cockney people and stuff. It's post dirty, in a dirty kind of way, a dirty lifestyle kind of way, is, you know, kind of interesting, you know, but it's hard, isn't it? It's really hard work. It's like wading through treacle, getting through. Oh,
it is. I mean,
yeah.
There was one film which I couldn't believe he was even in it for a start. Ian Ogilvy was playing.
Oh, I've seen that one. I've seen a trailer for that one.
This is how we killed in the old way, or something like that. There's a sequel.
We killed better in the old days.
I mean, I thought, how desperate is Ogilvy,
who's
quite a refined actor, not a
Cockney bastard,
Cockney cunt type actor. Well, how desperate is he to appear in this?
Amazing.
Yeah, it's called We Still Kill the Old Way. And it's basically about, Ogilvy is this retired gangster and he's living in Spain. And his brother, who is actually... You know, saying I was surprised to see Ogilvy in this. I was even more surprised to see Stephen Berkoff in it. But he is a cockney, isn't he? So yeah, he's in it. So he plays Ogilvy's brother, who gets beat up and killed by these feral youths on his way home. He's trying to stop them raping Danny Dyer's actual daughter, Danny Dyer.
Oh, yeah.
So she's in it.
Got a daughter called Danny Dyer.
So he gets killed. So Ogilvy comes back to avenge them, and he recruits his old gang, one of which is Burnside, played by, you know, Chris Ellison.
All the usual suspects.
James Cosmo, who you may know.
Oh, yeah.
Who's in Braveheart, who's a Scottish actor.
Yeah.
And this other Cockney, I can't remember, not a very famous one. So what they do is they avenge these utterly cocky bastards, and they torture them. There's one good scene where Burnside nails down this kid's hands to a chair. Though, typical of these type of films, you never get authentic screams from the torture. You know, if somebody was actually getting tortured like that, they wouldn't be going, they scream the fucking head off.
Crying and shitting themselves.
Yeah, they would. So yeah, so that's that, and it ends up with the shootout in the hospital, I think. But yeah, it wasn't that most terrible film, and it wasn't the worst of the lot that I saw. One of the things that I did want to try and watch, though, I found out you have to pay for it because it's only available on Vimeo. It's never actually had a physical release. It's called Gatwick Gangsters, right? And I'm looking at a cover for it, or a poster, you could say. It reminds me of like a Bend Over video, right? Because it's got a Union Jack as the backdrop. But listen to this stellar cast. You've got Dave Courtney. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
That sort of Cockney gangster.
Yeah.
Gary Bushell.
Oh, my God.
Bobby George.
Oh, I
who think... is holding a sawn-off shotgun on the cover.
I've seen some of this.
Yeah, you have seen Willie Thorne.
God, may he rest in peace.
Is Willie Thorne even from London? He's from the Midlands.
He is. He's from Leicester. That's why he's mates with Gary Lineker.
Yeah. It reminded me of a Cliff Twemlow film. You know, all you need to do is look at the trailer, because most of the film is in it.
Yeah.
Similar to a Cliff film or a Cliff trailer. It's unbelievable. And I once read this review from someone who actually paid to watch it, and it's an absolutely hilarious review. You can tell that they're really angry that they actually shelled out $2.99 for it, because it's just the biggest, most unwatchable pile of shit ever.
That is brilliant. Can I backtrack again, slightly tangent again, but it would have been great to have mentioned this before when we were talking about horror films. We were talking about the occult and many other interesting things to do with folklore and horror. But today I heard that Vangelis has passed away.
Yeah.
And of course, he was integral in making the seminal prog rock album 666, all about the devil.
Was it? I've not heard of that.
Yeah, have you not? Oh, man. Have you not heard that album? Oh, it's incredible. And the amazing song, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Ah, right.
If you haven't heard The Four Horsemen, Lee, you're in for a treat.
So is it an album by Vangelis called 666?
Well, by his band, Aphrodite's Child. But bassist and lead singer of Aphrodite's Child was none other than the great Demis Roussos, who most people know these days. Most people who are unaware of his brilliance only know him for Forever and Ever and Ever and Ever, I'll Be With You.
Or Kenny Everett doing him.
Or Kenny Everett doing it. Or him on Abigail's Party. Oh, don't you just love Demis Roussos? Oh,
I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one who thought he was called Dennis.
Yeah, most Roussos. Think he was Dennis, but it's Demis. Demis Roussos is a brilliant musician and an amazing singer. And if you listen to some Aphrodite's Child stuff, you'll see why. You Always Get in My Way. Stand in My Way. What a vocal that is. And The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. He was something else as a rock singer, I think.
Ah, and yeah, I only know him for Forever and Ever and Ever and Abigail's Part.
I promise you, Lee, have a listen to Four Horsemen. What a tune. You can hear it on YouTube. It's brilliant. Great. you will view the man with different ears and eyes. I'm trying to put the eyes in after that, because that was a wrong metaphor. You will view the man with different eyes, with different ears.
I'm on my second pint now, Dave, so I'll probably be buying it later. I'm downloading that from iTunes.
Well, Aphrodite's Child is worth a buy, because it is, there's no doubt about it, it is a very unusual album. It's got some very odd tracks on it, some very odd and unusual things. But the highlight probably is Four Horsemen, because it's a cracking tune. I mean, as a rock tune, it works today. And it's been copied a lot. You know, the drums and bass on it and everything are incredible. I'm going to play a bit of it now over the system.
Yeah, just remember, Metallica have got a really good song called The Four Horsemen from the first album.
I think 666 is like a seminal like album, like prog rock album. And I think a lot of rock bands have been quite influenced by it.
Yeah.
Four Horsemen tune. Like, Loved Up and I used to play it at the end sometimes of Brickhouse Night.
Right.
And it sounded amazing through the system, you know, like big. It's a big tune when it kicks in. Because it starts really soft with this Demis Roussos doing this very high falsetto. And did the Lamb reveal the first shield? Like this. And then it goes. That's pretty good for me at this time of night. And then it goes into this big rock tune. The first horse is red, second horse is black, first one was the green, next one was the red. And it goes, you know, it's big. It's a big tune. It's great.
My knowledge of Demis and Vangelis is severely limited. I only really know Vangelis for Chariots of Fire and Blade Runner, which I think he was involved with.
I wrote a song which I meant to record with the Interceptors, or as like a solo thing, in a similar vein as Midnight Cowboy. You know, when I did the Midnight Cowboy song with Blue, I was going to do a piece of music off Blade Runner as well. I'd called it I'll Wait Until Morning, and I was really, I loved it. And I'm thinking now, I really want to record that at some point. It's such a beautiful tune that I'd written this lyric for, and was singing on top of it. A very similar vein to what I did with Bluer Than Blue, which was Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah.
And never did it. And it's the first thing
You did that on Granada Reports, didn't you?
I did. I performed that on Granada Reports. That's correct. Yeah. Did very well for me, that track, really, because it got as many...
Meet Fred Talbot while you were there.
No, but he was on the sofa when it was announced. The end of the show. And now we've got a local band called The Interceptors, who are about to play for us their latest song, Bluer Than Blue. So here we go.
While you were describing that brilliantly sounding record, Dave, I was looking at an awful record, because this was going to be part of the Cockney Cunt podcast. And I have to say, it is seriously the most hideous thing I've ever come across. And it is this EastEnders sing-along album that came out in 1985, which features the cast doing 24 Cockney classics.
Oh, God!
So you've got... Oh. Unsurprisingly, maybe it's because I'm a Londoner, It's a Long Way to Tipperary, Pack Up Your Troubles, Don't Dilly Dally on the Way. It's got the most fucking horrible I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles.
Old Lambeth Way, You'll find them all doing the Lambeth Walk.
Ease up, Mother Brown, roll out the barrel.
Oh, I could smell them from here.
But the fucking cover, right, you've got the horrible EastEnders cast. Surrounding Tony Carpenter, if you remember him, Jamaican guy.
Jamaican guy, yeah.
He sat at the piano, and it's surrounded by the cast. Now, weirdly, I'm just completely out of character. Everybody is smiling. Now, nobody smiles ever on EastEnders.
Never. No.
You've just got...
Crest or crying on EastEnders.
Yeah. You've just got that horrible old bag. Pauline Fowler's mum. You've got Arthur Fowler. Pathetic Arthur Fowler. You've got Dirty Den holding...
Horrible... Arthur yeah. Spangler's
murderer,
spotty fucking daughter. What was she called?
The spotty one was Michelle, wasn't he? You could
smell the boiled cabbage, can't you, in their houses? It's just fucking horrible. EastEnders, disgusting.
And Pete Beale.
Oh, he was the worst. I hated him with his horrible little lisp. Yes. What's going on here? What's going on? Oh. Like he had a stroke. What was Murderer Grantham's song? Riders on the Storm. What is he singing? Gilles Taxi.
Is he a Cockney song about prison?
Yeah. I'm going straight. I am straight as an arrow.
Oh, my God.
He gave
horrible.
Me some lip, so I shot him in the back of the head. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is he actually dead, Leslie Grantham?
Yeah, he's dead now, isn't he?
Bloody hell, he is, isn't he?
Yeah. Of natural causes, nobody shot him in the back of the head. Can I just make a point as well? Do you remember, Lee? Do you remember sitting down and watching the most abhorrent live stand-up comedy show of all time, which was Mike Read, of course, who was in EastEnders?
Yes.
The vile Mike Read. And in the audience were all his fucking castmates.
Yeah,
and it was the most I had to go and wash myself after listening and watching that filth.
Was it called Mike Read Wallop?
Wallop. It should have been called Mike Read is a rapist. Or probably like something. Mike Read, he died before Operation Yew Tree could get anywhere near him.
Yeah.
What a shame.
I remember reading his book, Dave, and can you guess what the title was?
I am a rapist and murderer.
It was Triffitt.
Triffitt. Yeah, run around. Go. Remember run around. They let him do a kids show. They let him do it. He's the most horrible, vile man.
Didn't his son, and I'm not really, you know, this is, I'm going a bit serious now, but his son had schizophrenia, didn't he? And didn't he set himself on fire after shooting his mate?
Yeah, but yeah, we're going to say he shot his best mate first. Goes, you come in here, have a look at me dad's classic pistols. Oh, let's have a little bang. His mate's dead.
He did tell that unbelievable story about this family committing incest with each other.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and the punchline was something like, hey, granddad, I've got AIDS.
Yeah, yeah. And there's all the EastEnders cast laughing at his jokes.
You created this character. Just reminding me, you created this character called Mike Rape, didn't you?
I did. That's right. Mike Rape. I don't even know if I got to do him on Showbiz Asylum. I wish I had. That'd have been great. Yeah, great. Great, innit? Yeah. Mike Rape here. Oh, God, he's vile, man. But that, I couldn't believe watching that because there they were, like Grant fucking Mitchell. I can't even think of his real name. Ross Summit. And the other one.
Barbara Windsor.
Phil Mitchell.
Daniela Westbrook was there.
Yeah. You know the real names. I'm just like, well, I know Barbara Windsor because she's obviously like a fucking tart of the craze, isn't she? You know.
Yeah.
Carry on, tart of the craze.
Oh, they were lovely lads.
They were a little bit naughty. They were just a bit naughty, yeah. Like that Alan Partridge thing. What about your Uncle Dennis? Oh, my lovely Uncle Dennis. Yeah, you say he's lovely. Stabbed a man violently until he was dead.
Remember that? His guest on Knowing Me was Terry Norton.
Oh, Terry Norton's brilliant.
You want to get sacked in?
You get sacked in
so far, you get blown out the other side, son.
We've done a reconstruction. Is this what it was like? Taxi! He stabs the guy in death and hails a cab.
Grantham.
Oh, he's brilliant. Oh, God, I love that.
Oh, that reminds me of that amazing character by Ricky Grover, Buller.
Oh, Buller's brilliant.
Oh, Buller was amazing, wasn't
he? A new mouth. He sliced you a new mouth.
Yeah. That's a nice smile. Would you like another mare? I'm a lovely guy, but I will open you up like a tin of beans.
Very naughty. Oh, God.
I thought that was one of the most genius characters ever, that. I was annoyed that it was never massive.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. Buller was amazing. Going back to the Mike Reed thing, I just found every joke on that fucking live stand-up thing to be so aggressive, and it always ended up with like some old guy shagging a young woman.
Well, it was like that when we saw that
indictment of the 70s, really.
It was like, Well, it's like when we saw that awful Jim Bowen live stand-up.
Oh, God, Blurters.
What's that called?
We used to call them Blurters, Rubber Johnnies, in our day. Blurters.
Oh, God, it was just terrible, wasn't it?
It was cringe.
Yeah, the last thing you want to think about is Jim Bowen having sex. God.
At least Manning could tell a joke without sounding like he was going to kill you. I mean, the thing with, like, bloody Mike Reed, he always sounded like he wanted to fucking kill you when he told a joke. Manning sort of did it with charm, even if he was being a racist, xenophobic, fucking sexist pig. He did it with a bit of charm and a bit of style.
Oh, God, I'm just looking at these Jim Bowen videos. There's one called You Can't Tell These Anymore.
Oh, yeah. This is the thing with these old comedians. You can't do this kind of humour. No one thinks it's funny.
There's another one. I think this was the one we watched, and it's got a bullseye type theme on the cover. It says, The Jokes You Won't Hear on TV. Super smashing great. It's good. That's the subtitle.
Oh, God.
What a load of shit.
I've never seen, for example, any kind of stand-up by that guy Jethro.
But he's massive, isn't he? He died recently, didn't he?
I know. It's like Chubby Brown. I've seen a bit of Chubby Brown, and I thought he was excellent doing his little bit on League of Gentlemen. I can kind of see his kind of charm, and I can kind of see the argument. I suppose it's a bit like Manning's argument. He takes the piss out of everything. So, you know, what's the problem?
I have seen a Chubby Brown video that was absolutely hilarious, and it may have had a lot of stuff cut out. I know he was a dirty bastard, but I never really thought he did racist jokes. And I don't even know if he necessarily did. He was never on the TV, was he? It was always these sell-through videos you had to buy.
I'll have to have a watch. I'll have to see some of the stuff. What's very interesting, of course, is the town in the League of Gentlemen is called Royston Vasey. And that is Roy Chubby Brown's real name. His real name is Royston Vasey. And that's why, of course, they decided to pluck him out of televisual obscurity, even though national he's not obscure at all, of course, to be in the League of Gentlemen. And he's very, very funny because he's a brilliant swearer. You know, he's a brilliant swearer. Best. You know, and that is a gift, you know, to be a great swearer. I think he's a great gift. Fair play to the man.
Yeah, so this EastEnders album, man, I mean, God, keeping Cockney knees in a perpetual state of elevation.
Does Mike Rape feature on that album as well?
He's not. It was 85, so he wasn't in it then, I don't think.
Oh, it was
that
pre...
That was when EastEnders launched, wasn't it, 85?
Rape's been dead a while, hasn't he? He's not. He's not around, is he, today?
I don't think so.
No, I think he's gone, yeah. You know, I bet he'd have been quaking in his fucking boots. I really get a vibe about him. You know, I get a vibe that some dodgy man, fucking dodgy man.
Cockney Wanker out of Viz was clearly based on him, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Really, definitely. Mm. Dirty, dodgy Cockney bastard. Mm. Fantastic.
I wonder if his breath smelled beautiful, Dave. Like the other Mike Reed.
No, that's not the right Mike Reed. I mean... The other bigot, the one who's on the radio, the other racist bastard, the one with good hair, not the one with bad hair.
He's not a racist, is he, Mike Reed?
Yeah, the radio.
I know he did a UKIP song. Was it?
Yeah, oh yeah, he's totally. He's a total fucking send the buggers back, and he's a cunt.
I can't believe that about Mike Reed. He's the one who banned Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Righteous Mike Reed.
Righteous Mike. Dirty righteous Mike. You know, it's always the righteous ones, isn't it? I bet he likes having people shove stuff up his arse or something, you know, in reality. I bet he's a really dirty bastard, you know. The ones who make themselves, like Cliff. You know what I mean? Squeaky clean Cliff. I bet you he's got a glass coffee table. Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, you know what I'm saying? Heard some.
And he likes the young chaps to do the shitting. The young chaps!
Oh, my Lord. Well, I remember him getting roped into U-Tree. And my brother-in-law was telling me this story that he'd heard. And I don't believe it. He was saying that, there was all these, like, sex parties and... Cliff was there with Jimmy, and Cliff was known as Kitty. Like, why? Why was he known as Kitty? You know, that I don't believe Cliff. I mean, Cliff did get accused, didn't he, of assaulting some lad in a concert, but...
I'm wondering, if you'd like to suck my dick.
I mean, there is rumours that he's in a relationship with his housekeeper, isn't there? But why didn't he just come out if he's gay? I mean, no one's arsed, are they?
I think when he's getting it, he goes, thank you, God!
Well, you know that Jesus! Stars in Their Eyes clip, Dave, that I played on the last Gary Glitter podcast?
Oh, yeah.
It brilliant. Was from a Christmas special. And, oh, my God, the guy, there's a guy who does Cliff Richard singing Mistletoe and Wine on that. He's just, oh, my God, he's just, oh, what a wet blanket he is. It's a horrible man that does Cliff Richard. He's just,
I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah.
Listeners, look up the gentleman in question doing Cliff Richard on Stars in Their Eyes. And also, listeners, if you haven't heard, Aphrodite's Child, Four Horsemen, You Haven't Lived. So get on the old YouTube and have a listen.
Well, just thinking about, I was thinking about Gary Glitter because I was thinking that Ukraine could have entered Gary Glitter singing their Eurovision entry and it would have won.
Exactly. Anything. Yeah. You could have done a shit in a beer can.
Could have had could have done an anal cunt cover.
An anal cunt tune. Exactly.
I'm not into Eurovision at all, right? But I can't help feeling quite annoyed that the year that we came second and probably would have won.
Yeah, yeah.
We lost out to a sympathy vote.
I know. I have to say, it was a sympathy vote. There's no doubt about it. And Sam Ryder would have won. And it's quite a nice little tune, you know, and he's a good singer and everything. And fair play. You know, it's a good little pop tune.
What, the Sam Ryder one?
Yeah, it's a good little
I don't even know it, to be honest.
It's quite a nice little pop song. I'm not dissing it at all. I don't want to diss it. And we had a lot of fun watching it. Sort of cheering on, hey, even after Brexit, some Europeans love us. And how do we deserve it? Thank you, because we're a bunch of wankers for voting out of Europe and it's fucked Britain up big time. Anyway, so we were watching that, cheering that on, blah, blah, blah. But when there was this massive public sway towards Ukraine, I was quite pleased, really, because I have to say, I thought the Ukraine song was better than Britain's.
Did you? Well,
I loved it. It's mad. It's fucking insane with the rap and then all like the traditional folk music. I thought, yeah, get in. I'll have a bit of that shit. You know, I thought it was a lot of fun, Eurovision this year. There was some really mad shit on it.
I suppose that's what it's there for, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm just reading, Dave, that Mike Reed starred in the classic adult pantomime Pussy in Boots.
Oh, there you go.
Which was a spin-off of Puss in Boots, where Mike Reed played the main role of Big Dick. Also in 1994, he provided a voiceover for one of the cows in the Anchor Butter advert.
God. Hey, mate, I've found it. This is Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Okay, we will bid goodbye. Goodbye, listeners.
Listen to this. Demis Roussos. Takes a bit. Takes a while.
Coming back to Earth again, as he said.